Hi, this is Julia Walkling from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine.
Thank you, Richard, for those kind words, and thank you particularly Mary Lee and all the other organizers of these Longfellow Days here in Brunswick. I must confess that we have a new puppy at home, a Springer Spaniel, and he tried to eat my favorite pair of glasses. So I'm going to try to use them, but if they fall apart in my hand, please bear with me. I have another pair tucked away somewhere. But it's a variation of the old excuse that the dog ate my homework. But anyway, I'm really happy to be back here, not only in Brunswick, particularly at Bowdoin College, and particularly in this room, which has always been one of my favorite rooms at the college. I want to make sure, can you hear me well enough in back with the mic? Okay. I welcome any excuse to return to Brunswick, of course, but as the years pass, these returns begin to have a bit of an elegiac character to them. Each year, many of the people that I remember from Brunswick and Topsom in the 80s and 90s are no longer with us, and it gives a melancholy tone to these visits. On the other hand, one of the great advantages of living in a college community is that there's a constant inflow of new faces, not just students, but new faculty. And I think particularly in the case of coastal Maine, so many people who've had a career somewhere else have chosen quite wisely to come here to live. And so this wonderful mix of new faces and old that has greeted me here today is very heartwarming. So thank you all for being here. But in that elegiac vein, I did want to pay a passing tribute to two people who were involved in Longfellow Days earlier on. I spoke about, I think it was 5 years ago, over at Fort Andros in one of the earlier programs. And in the audience that evening were Herb Corson and Roy Greeson, both members of the Bowdoin College English Department at one time. I just wanted to mention them since they are no longer with us, alas. I'm not sure they would enjoy having their names linked together because I don't think they really liked each other very much. I think maybe more correctly, I should say they had some professional differences, but they were both two of the people who gave a flavor to this community during the long time that they did live here. Roy was, of course, president of Bowdoin College in the 1980s and a great Longfellow enthusiast, as was Herb. Roy was a man of great dignity. He had gravitas to spare. Herb, on the other hand, as many of you, I'm sure, know, was a charming rake and a poet and a wonderful teacher, particularly when the subject was Shakespeare. So I just wanted to salute their shades before we get going here and say that we do miss them and appreciate what they did to get this the Longfellow Day celebration going. Before I get into my own topic today, which is the long friendship of Dickens and Longfellow, I did want to make two kind of plugs. One is for Winter Weekend, which Richard mentioned. This year's Winter Weekend is dedicated to Great Expectations. It's a Friday evening, all-day Saturday program over in Kresge Auditorium. And we do these programs each year when Bowdoin goes on its spring break, so we have access to parking and dining services and all that. If you don't know about it, I urge you to go on the website of the Maine Humanities Council, which has the details. The program this year, I think, is more or less sold out at 180 attendees, but there is a waiting list, and there will always be some last-minute cancellations. So if you're interested, it's well worth at least looking into and perhaps getting your name on that list. And keep an eye out for next year's program. I don't know who the author will be. We're going to vote on it as a group this year. But it's a wonderful occasion and brings together a lot of people who see each other each year at these programs and who are very devoted general readers and people who love to talk about the books and to enjoy the themed dinner and all that we provide. So please keep Winter Weekend in mind. My other plug is for a book that just came out by a friend of mine, Christoph Irmscher. He is a professor of English who helped in some of those teacher programs that Richard just mentioned. He was at Harvard. He's now out at the University of Indiana. And he has written on Longfellow, among other things. But his most recent book, which was reviewed in the Times a couple of weeks ago, is about the 19th century scientist Louis Agassiz, who taught for many years at Harvard. I guess he was Swiss by birth, but he immigrated to the United States, and he ended up marrying into a very prominent Beacon Hill family in Boston, and he spent most of his career as a Harvard professor. And he was one of these, again, a polymath, more accurately so than me. He was a scientist in the early days before specialization, so he did everything from studying glaciers. He's the man who more or less discovered that there had been an ice age in Europe. Glaciers, marine biology, paleontology, zoology, botany, et cetera, et cetera. He was also rather like Parker Cleveland a generation earlier here in Brunswick. He was a very popular public lecturer who wanted to take his knowledge of science out of the classroom or the lab and into the public. So he played a very large role, for instance, in setting up the Harvard Museums that you can still visit today. And Christoph has done a wonderful biography of him that Houghton Mifflin just published, and I recommend it to you. It includes a good bit about Longfellow. They were very close friends. The two families were very close together. In the 1850s and 60s, they summered together at Nahant. And in his marine biology excursions, Agassiz would often return and leave a giant turbot or a giant jellyfish on Longfellow's doorstep at the cottage. You know, it was a kind of insider's joke, but they were very close. But the problem is Agassiz's reputation, as you may well know, is very shadowed by two things, really. One, just an error on his part, another, a kind of moral failing. He was very anti-Darwinian and very outspoken about it, and even more seriously, he was someone who indulged in the pseudoscience of racial discrimination and on the basis of bone structure and whatever. And he argued quite vociferously that not only were Africans an inferior group to Western Europeans and North Americans, but that they were actually a different species. And he had a lot of scientific, you know, quote-unquote, evidence for this. This did not go over particularly well in abolitionist Boston, as you can imagine, but he was taken up very much by the Southern intellectuals of the 1850s and early 60s who were trying to defend slavery not just as an economic necessity, but as a positive good. And so after the Civil War, his reputation was certainly harmed by this side of his scientific or pseudoscientific activity. He did make one final long expedition to the Amazon, which is remembered now mostly because the young William James was aboard the boat and wrote much about that trip. So at any rate, Agassiz is a book. If you're interested in 19th century Boston, 19th century Harvard, history of science, history of Longfellow and his friends, it's really a book to look out for in adding it to your reading list. So this is a diversion from what I really want to talk about, but in a way it is not, because I mentioned how close Longfellow and Agassiz were. Longfellow, there's absolutely no evidence that Longfellow believed in any of the racial theories of Agassiz and his followers, on the contrary. And Longfellow was a very close friend of Asa Gray, another Harvard scientist who was a Darwinian and a very eloquent one. So I think it proves that, in at least in Longfellow's mind, you didn't have to agree with him to be his friend, and a useful lesson for all of us in these days, these highly partisan days. So this theme of literary friendship or intellectual friendship or collegial friendship within an academic community, that's in some sense the subtext of what I want to talk about today. And I want to raise the question of particularly friendships between writers or among groups of writers and ask you to reflect on whether you think this helps their writing or in some way inhibits it or damages it or gives them excuses not to write, perhaps, things they might otherwise have written. We have, a romantic notion of the writer as a very lonely, solitary, driven, inward-looking character, and there are certainly plenty of examples you could come up with. J.D. Salinger might be the patron saint of this particular view of literary life. But think of Thoreau and his deliberate, chosen isolation. And think here in Maine of Marguerite Yourcenar, living fairly unknown in Northeast Harbor on MDI for years and years before she became famous in her 80s. One of the great writers in 20th century French literature who lived really obscurely here in Maine and whether to what extent that harmed her career or not, you know, it's very interesting to debate. On the other hand, there are also writers who've sought out other writers, but not always with the best motives. Think of Hemingway always trying to humiliate Scott Fitzgerald and often succeeding. Or think of the quarrel, the famous public quarrel between Mary McCarthy and Lillian Hellman, which ended up in court. I think of Norman Mailer trying to punch out everybody. And even Whitman. Whitman, you know, in his later life, was a somewhat isolated figure. Much of his poetry is about an individual wanderer, a very solitary persona. But Whitman, certainly in the 1840s, in his New York days, Brooklyn and Manhattan, he was a member of a group of writers and journalists and actors and actresses who met in Pfaff's Tavern to drink beer and talk about literature and whatever. So it's a complicated question, and we could spend a lot of time thinking of examples on both sides. I don't know what the modern situation is like entirely. I live in Brooklyn now in a neighborhood that is full of young writers who are hanging out with each other. I'm not sure how much writing gets done, but it's part of the atmosphere of the place to be among people with some kind of literary avocation. And I think also of all the workshops, writing workshops, there's something like 300 MFA programs around the country now, and presumably those people are on reasonably friendly terms with each other, and this may carry over into their careers. But what I want to look at today is the 19th century experience of these two writers in particular, and some of their other associates. And what I suppose my message in this case is that it's possible for two writers, even though they don't see each other very often, to enjoy each other's company, to keep in touch, and in some ways to draw on each other for, I'm not sure I'd use the word inspiration, but at least some sustaining force that helps at various moments in their writing careers. Now, I want to look particularly at the four moments in their respective lives when Longfellow and Dickens cross paths in a serious, and then in several cases, a prolonged way, particularly two episodes in 1842, when they were both still obviously very young men. The first was when Dickens visited Boston on his first American tour in January of 1842. And then that fall, when Longfellow was in Europe, he visits Dickens on his way home by way of London, on his way back to Cambridge. And then, much more briefly, Dickens' second visit to America in 1867, and Longfellow's brief call on Dickens and his family in Kent in 1868, when Longfellow was and his entourage were touring Europe. The context of this 1842 period, though, I want to sketch out very briefly, or try to sketch out, and that's just to remind you that there were a number of famous Europeans who came to America for any number of reasons, sometimes to escape Europe, political oppression, whatever, sometimes to make their fortunes, sometimes out of pure spirit of adventure, and sometimes to write a book. The most famous, of course, was Alexis de Tocqueville, who in the early 1830s, in the age of Andrew Jackson, came to America ostensibly to study the American prison system. Try to imagine a moment when Europeans would come to America to study prison reform, and you know how things have changed. But Tocqueville, he didn't stay here a long time. He was a very young man. I think he was maybe 26 at this point. He was extraordinarily observant, and he had a wonderfully analytical mind. And he goes back to France, and he writes what in its English translation is called Democracy in America, first volume 1835, another in 1840. And it's not an uncritical study of Jacksonian democracy in this country, but it is one that's in many ways sympathetic to what was going on here, what people were trying to do, this great experiment in republicanism and equality. And he, of course, had the French French politics in the back of his mind, and it was a time of a restoration of the monarchy, obviously, in France after Napoleon. But he was always not only reporting what he saw in America, he was trying to predict what America would be like in the future. And his book is immortal, obviously, and it's one of those books that you can quote to any purpose, for whether on the right or the left. There's always something that Tocqueville had to say that you can work into your argument. Somewhat in the same vein, there was an English woman, Harriet Martineau, who was here roughly the same time. She wrote a three-volume book that sold very, very well called Society in America, published 1837. She was an English liberal who, again, was not uncritical. She hated slavery, for example, and she was very suspicious of a lot of the mores of American commercial society. But she gave in toto, she gave a pretty positive view of what was happening here. And this was not necessarily a popular view in England. There were still a lot of people in England, particularly in the upper classes and the aristocracy, who, of course, hoped to see the American experiment fail. Martineau was, to some degree, responding to that attitude. Perhaps most memorable of all, from the English point of view, was a book that had appeared a little bit earlier in 1832, which was Mrs. Frances Trollope's Domestic Manners of the Americans. Mrs. Trollope was the novelist Anthony Trollope's mother, and she was a writer herself, a very prolific one, and she was a great wit, and she had a very acerbic tongue, and she was very easily offended. And believe me, in her American travels, she found much to be offended by. She had had an unpleasant experience in Cincinnati, and she lost a lot of money in a business venture there. But she got over that, and in order to recoup her loss to some extent, she wrote this travel book, which was a big bestseller on both sides of the Atlantic, in which she described her peregrinations around the United States. And she gave wonderful catalogs of all the things that were going wrong here. One thing that she offended her the most was the American custom of spitting, chewing tobacco and spitting. And she was one of a number of visitors who pointed out when you went to visit the marble halls of the new Capitol building in Washington, you know, up to about the 2-foot level, they were brown. Whereas even with the presence of spittoons, Congress was not very efficient at spitting. And from her European, from her genteel English perspective, this was just repulsive behavior. But aside from those mannerisms that offended her, what really bothered her, I think, was that she found here a great leveling of rank. In Europe, whether you're a liberal or a conservative, still you've grown up, you live your life in a system of various hierarchies, some more rigid than others, perhaps, some degree of mobility, perhaps occasionally accessible to the few. But basically, you spent your life in a certain niche in society, and it was very difficult to get out of it. You could fall easily, I should say, but it's very difficult to rise out of it. And tied to this was the American lack of deference. I remember when I went to England as a student around 1970, I was astonished that just because of the fact I suppose I was an American student, so many older people would call me sir and would often do this, and it was still Britain has changed enormously since then, but it was still a very deferential society, and if you were identified. Sort of an American visitor was often identified as kind of honorary, genteel. You were given a degree of deference that I found very strange and kind of off-putting. But she had just the opposite experience, of course, in America, as many of these European visitors did. So Dickens certainly had read Martineau, and he certainly read Mrs. Trollope. And I don't know why, maybe Lillian would explain why she's always called Mrs. Trollope, but it's not, it's just Martineau, but at any rate, that seems to be the usage. He had read their books. I don't think he'd probably seen Tocqueville at this time, but he was prepared to some degree to what he would find in the United States. And his own motives for his first trip in 1842 were certainly curiosity about the country. I mean, this was his Republic of the Imagination, to use a phrase he once wrote. He was very, as someone who was very reform-minded, he was certainly intensely interested in what the Americans had accomplished in the new republic. He was also, and he kept this very secret, he was also looking for material for a book. This was going to be a commercial venture in a sense. He was gathering a book, perhaps he conceived it more like Martineau's book and less like Mrs. Trollope's, but he was always taking notes and observing things and seeking out places to visit that he thought would be good raw material for such a book. He was also very curious about his American readership. He knew he was very popular in this country by that time. And connected with this is his great concern about the issue of international copyright, which at that time did not exist. What happened was that if a popular English novelist published a book like Dickens or Thackeray or any number of others, a copy would soon find its way to New York or Philadelphia or Boston, and the publisher there would have it reset and sold at a considerable profit because he did not have to pay royalties to the author. The same thing happened in the opposite direction, American writers in Britain, but there were fewer of them that sold well, Washington Irving being the notable exception at this point. So there was this real injustice here of writers not being rewarded for their work within a large span of their readership on both sides of the Atlantic. There's some interesting modern parallels with the current questions about intellectual property and the Chinese theft of it in regard to a lot of popular music and movies and what have you. But Dickens was really very concerned about this because he realized how much money he was losing to start with, and his sense of justice was offended, I think, too, and that there was this, you know, this love-hate relationship between Americans and Britons that certainly entered into this. There actually wasn't an international copyright convention until 1886, long after Dickens' death. There was the Bern Convention signed in Switzerland, and the United States didn't even really enter into it until the 1950s. So it was a big problem, certainly for anyone who was trying to have a literary career. So that's the background of his arrival in Boston. It was a difficult crossing. I think it took 18 days. Dickens was seasick most of the time. He was traveling with his wife, Catherine. And if you want to know anything about Catherine, the world's leading expert on her, the author of a wonderful biography that's really a landmark in Dickens' study, is seated here in the third row, and Lillian Nader, professor of English at Bates. And I think you'll be hearing from her later in this series, talking about Great Expectations. Is that correct? And she's also part of our Winter Weekend panel of scholars. So I'm delighted she's here. I'm nervous that she's here because she knows 10,000 times more about Dickens than I do. And I hope she will jump in if I get anything wrong. But thank you. I appreciate your being here. So he's traveling with his wife. They were still on, I think, reasonably good terms at that time. And it's a troubled marriage, as you may know already, that will have unfortunate circumstances later on. But one irony of Dickens traveling with his wife at this point is that Dickens, many scholars have argued, really had far more affinity for male company than for female. Now, there were a lot of women in his life, his wife, two of her sisters, and his, as I'll say in a moment, his very young mistress. So it's not that he wasn't interested in female company, but he didn't feel, like many Victorian gents, he didn't feel entirely at home in female society. He much preferred to be with the boys. And Rosemary Bodenheimer at Boston College has written a very interesting chapter in her book, Knowing Dickens, about this. He lived primarily in a world of men. His career began in the eminently male domain of cheap newspaper publication and competitive reporting, but his professional and leisure hours were centered on friendships or working relationships with other men. She goes on to say that while Dickens' romantic and sexual life was directed toward women, it took conventional Victorian forms. He idealized virginal young girls. He was fascinated with fallen women, et cetera, et cetera. And a reader of Dickens' letters in particular readily sees that his most genial, effective life was engaged with his male friends. Males are his confidants, his companions in play and travel, and his ways of measuring himself. And I think you'll see this very much, particularly in this first American visit. He was welcomed even before he got to Boston, when the ship pulled into Boston Harbor, the pilot boats came out, and they were full of newspaper reporters who wanted to be the first to get the story. He was greeted by a huge throng at the dock. He was escorted to his hotel, the Tremont House, which it was the best hotel in Boston. It stood at the corner of Beacon Street and Tremont Street. He was given a lavish suite in that hotel, and he was expected almost immediately to start holding court there, as it were, and to hold a daily levee, when anyone who wanted to could come shake his hand and welcome him to America and ask him some questions or whatever, or just be able to say they'd met the great man. He attracted a more select group of visitors as well at this time. A delegation of the young men of Boston came to see him to invite him to dinner, and that included not only Longfellow, who at this point was teaching at Harvard, but Charles Sumner, Longfellow's very close friend, Charles Sumner, later the great abolitionist senator. It included Cornelius Felton, who was later to be president of Harvard during the Civil War. He was a classicist, a Greek scholar, who was apparently one of the funniest, most convivial, most enjoyable men in greater Boston, Cambridge. He and Dickens became very close friends and corresponded over the years, often about, they had a kind of running joke through the letters about Felton's love for oysters and how many he could eat in one sitting. And it was that kind of boyish or collegiate humor that was very much part of this male bonding. And he also met James Fields, who was later to be a very important figure in his life as his American publisher and someone who did pay royalties to British authors. And Fields was, Ticknor & Fields was the most famous literary publisher of certainly 19th century Boston, representing Longfellow, Hawthorne, and many other figures of the literary world at that time and place. Now, not everyone was impressed with this young Mr. Dickens, although they were impressed by his celebrity, certainly, and he was quite famous. Richard Henry Dana, Jr., who had come back from his own adventures in the South Seas and was a Boston lawyer at this point, he wrote in his journal after meeting Dickens that he had a hearty, offhand manner, far from well-bred, and a rapid, dashing way of talking. You admire him, and there is a fascination about him which keeps your eyes on him, yet you cannot get over the impression that he is a low-bred man. So here is this Bostonian, being more snobbish than an Englishman, perhaps, although Dickens had run into the same attitude at home. Dickens is identified as a Cockney sometimes, meaning someone who'd grown up in other than genteel London. He's identified as lower middle class in so many words, as someone who has kind of pushed himself up the ranks and has a somewhat disreputable air from his association with writers and actors and what have you. Longfellow, on the other hand, took a much more generous view of the new arrival. He wrote to his father back in Portland a very enthusiastic description of Dickens, whom he called a glorious fellow, and the greatest possible enthusiasm exists among all classes for him here. He had not a moment's rest, calls innumerable, invitations innumerable, and is engaged three deep for the remainder of his stay in the way of dinners and parties. He is a gay, free, and easy character, a fine, bright face, blue eyes, long, dark hair, and withal a slight dash of the Dick Swiveller about him. Swiveller is a character in the old, a kind of easygoing character in the old curiosity shop. So here's Dickens drawing a very different reaction from two somewhat similar Americans who have met him, to people from the Boston-Cambridge literary establishment. But what I think is most interesting about this is that Longfellow and Sumner take Dickens on a walk around Boston. I mean, you'd love to have been there at the time. They take him to hear Father Taylor preach at the Sailors' Bethel, a famous church for sailors, which still exists in the North End. They took him to Copp's Hill, the Bering, what's now Bering Ground, a National Historic Site. It was where the British guns had been in place during the early stages of the American Revolution. And they took him to the Old North Church, which, as you well know, 20 years later, Longfellow would immortalize in Paul Revere's Ride. So they gave him this kind of, the Boston of the American Revolution from the American point of view, I think because he was intensely interested in seeing that. One thing that always impressed people who met Dickens was not only his wardrobe. He was a very fancy dresser. In some ways, he was much more a man of the Regency in his attire, maybe, than a man of the early Victorian period. The Bostonians were very austere in their well-cut black suits. And here he was running around in green velvet and elaborate brocaded waistcoats and odd-colored clubs and what have you. They realized he was very theatrical. I mean, that was not the style of Boston literary society, which was very straight-laced in most respects. But Dickens had this, you know, effusive, bigger-than-life quality to him, and which was part of his charm, but it took a little bit of getting used to, I think. There's a story, and he was much more outspoken than any of these Bostonians. There's a story of a dinner party he was invited to among the great and the good of Beacon Hill, and you know, in the course of the conversation, one of the gentlemen said, he introduced the question of, who was the more beautiful lady, the Duchess of Sutherland or Mrs. Caroline Norton? It was a famous beauty of early 19th century England. And Dickens considered a half a second, and he said, well, you know, in the standards of pure beauty alone, the Duchess is obviously the superior specimen. But, you know, Mrs. Norton is the more kissable. And, you know, there's a stunned silence around the mahogany table. That's just not something a gentleman said in the proper company about a lady in Boston in 1842. But please remember, Boston in those days, it wasn't quite as prudish as it became later in this century, but it already had inklings in that direction. There was criticism of Longfellow, for example, for having used the word stallion in a poem. That was considered slightly indecent. One thing to consider at this point regarding this visit in 1842 is the relative literary standing of the two writers. Longfellow was older by 5 years. He was already well settled into a Harvard career as a respectable academic. He had 2 volumes of poetry, which had sold very well in this country, as well as other assorted writing to his credit. Dickens, by this point, though, was already a very, very famous man. He had been first recognized for his essays that he published under the pen name of Boz, B-O-Z, in 1833. These were satirical sketches in a kind of genial vein about mostly about life in London among people of his circle and other young men living in the town at that time. He became even more famous for the publication of the Pickwick Papers in 1837. And in the years just before his visit, he had written not only The Old Curiosity Shop, as I just mentioned, but Oliver Twist and Nicholas Nickleby. As you know, these books were not published necessarily as books. They came out serialized, sometimes as individual units or sometimes as chapters in the various magazines that he was editing. But they were very, commercially very successful, and he became a major public figure in London. It's an interesting question. If his ship had struck a reef off New York Harbor in January of 1842, and there had been no more Charles Dickens, what his reputation might have been, whether his books would... I think he would have been remembered for Oliver Twist, if nothing else. Pickwick Papers might still be read as kind of a period piece. The illustrations that were done for his books by Cruikshank and by an artist who went by the name of Fizz might be still highly collectible because they're such wonderful documents of early Victorian London. But, you know, I'm not sure that he would be the subject of a great deal of academic attention outside of specialists in Victorian literature. The great books were still ahead of him. Starting in 1849, David Copperfield, I mentioned only what I think are the 4 great ones. There were a number of others, other novels. David Copperfield, Bleak House, 1852-53, Great Expectations, 1860-61, and Our Mutual Friend in 1864-65. And they have those multiple dates because, again, they were serialized, some of them weekly, some of them monthly. And that contributed certainly to his accessibility as a writer for people who maybe could not afford a Morocco-bound volume. So here he is, drawing these huge crowds and at the same time making friendships with the young literary people of the time. And some of these friendships, as in the case of Felton and Longfellow, and even Charles Sumner, remained quite strong throughout Dickens' life. So when he finally left Boston after all this celebrating and dining and walking and oyster eating and what have you, he headed first to Worcester and then on to Hartford, and everything was going pretty well up to that point, but by the time he got to Hartford, the American newspapers had discovered what he had been saying in public about the copyright law, and what basically they took it as Well, two things. One, that he was accusing the Americans of stealing from him, which in a sense he was, and they were. And secondly, that this trip was not for any noble purpose. It was a purely commercial venture in which he was trying to push his case for making more money. And Americans were very quick to take offense by any criticism from the British, as you can imagine, and that was a good example of it. So throughout the rest of his American trip, which lasted 6 months, he was constantly hounded by the newspapers on this subject of his audacity in criticizing American law and American publishing customs. But that did not reduce the size of the crowds. He went on to New Haven in New York City. There was the great Boz Ball on Valentine's Day at the Park Theater, and there was a great banquet at a local hotel chaired by Washington Irving. Everyone of any significance in New York was competing for a ticket for these things. And he went on to Philadelphia, where he met Edgar Allan Poe and had a very interesting conversation, I think, on two occasions with them. He proceeded to Washington, where he was received by President Tyler in a very odd kind of, I'm not sure Tyler entirely knew who he was, but he did make it, Dickens did make the courtesy call. But everyone else certainly knew who he was. One newspaper reporter of the day said it was like the crowds that he drew were those that resembled throwing corn among hungry chickens. Everyone just came running. And it's an interesting image because they only came running for the corn as if they were hungry chickens. They were pecking at him, too. They were constantly pestering Dickens, whether for an autograph, a comment, a handshake. He could go nowhere and be left alone. And that was very flattering. Dickens had a somewhat unstable sense of his own identity, particularly in a social sense. And he realized he was not, some people would not consider him a born a gentleman. And so he emotionally he drew a lot, I think, from the adoration of these crowds. Yet at the same time, it was a terrible nuisance, and he and his wife were hassled and harassed and bothered, and they hardly had a moment's rest anywhere. He had planned to go as far as south as Charleston, South Carolina, but he got to Richmond, and he was totally offended by the institution of slavery. He saw slaves working the fields, working the hotel he was staying in. He read the advertisements for runaways in the local newspapers. He saw the slave markets. And he was always, I think, anti-slavery to some degree or another, but all of a sudden it became a very visceral reaction as a result of this exposure to the peculiar institution in the South. And so he abandoned the plan to go any farther south, where South Carolina would have been an even worse scenario, perhaps, for him, and headed west. And I want to just pause for a moment on the slavery question, because it's going to connect with Longfellow and at the end of my remarks. There are perhaps two theories of why it made Dickens so upset. One is that we now know, and most of his contemporaries did not know this, but we now know that at an age when Longfellow was a Bowdoin student here, Dickens had been sent to work by his improvident parents in a blacking warehouse in the Covent Garden neighborhood of London. And blacking is the charcoal product they used on boots and stoves and what have you. And his job was at a window and paste labels on the tins of blacking as they were produced. And it's not certain quite how long he stayed there. He said 6 months in some accounts. There's some evidence now it may have been as long as 13 to 14 months. But it was a humiliating experience for a 12-year-old boy. He felt exposed to the public. He felt degraded because he was having to mix with working-class people that he felt were below him. And this idea of a kind of enforced labor, it wasn't slavery, but to a 12-year-old it might have seemed like it. I think that made a deep emotional impression on him, and it comes through in a lot of his novels, that the idea of the child victim who appears again and again throughout Dickens' work. And the other thing, of course, his father, who was a charming man in many ways, but had no ability to handle money. He was being put in debtor's prison in the Marshalsea at this point, and Dickens had to go visit him and would later write about that experience. So those two things, his father in prison and his own experience in this kind of enforced, humiliating labor, I think made him And Dickens, you know, emotions were bigger than life. In that sense, it made him very sensitive to the slave experience. He could empathize with African-American slaves in a way that perhaps a proper Bostonian and certainly a Southerner would not have done. So that's the sort of the background for that particular part of the trip. When, as I say, he went on west as far as St. Louis and went back to Niagara Falls, where he recovered from all this overexposure, made a quick trip to Montreal, back to New York, and back to London. When he and his wife arrived back in Liverpool, they had a reaction that I suppose a lot of travelers have, wherever they're coming from or to. That is, they were more of what they had been before they left. They were more British than they realized. The American experience had drawn so many contrasts that they felt when they saw the green fields and the little villages and the churches and, you know, the peaceful quiet of the English countryside, they were very, very glad to be home. But Dickens was not going to let his experience in America go to waste. He used he wrote a wonderful series of letters to his friend John Foster, who was sort of his literary advisor and to some extent his agent. Foster fortunately saved these letters. Dickens made a big effort to burn most of his correspondence to hide certain aspects of his life later, and he asked his friends to do the same, but Foster did not. The letters are some of the best writing that Dickens did. They're funny, they're fresh, they're immediate, they're satirical, they're full of life and energy and this, you know, the young art writer's reaction to all this crazy Americanness that he was for the first time coming into contact with. So he used those letters when he got back and his own notebooks to produce a book called American Notes, which is not a particularly fascinating book to read. He padded it with a lot of material he got from other sources. But it was a big seller on both sides of the Atlantic and added to some degree to the American feeling that he had misrepresented them and indeed had offended them deeply and the criticisms had come through. He didn't stop there. He went on to write Martin Chuzzlewit, which in its middle chapters takes place in America and again draws on a lot of his experiences in this first trip. The Dickens biographer Clara Tomlin, in her very interesting biography, lists, she offers this catalog of the things that Charles Dickens hated about America and expressed in the pages of Martin Chuzzlewit. I don't know that this is one of Dickens' more frequently read novels these days. It's perhaps famous for a few of his characters, like Mrs. Gamp, but it's an interesting comment on his attitude towards Americans. And I will quickly add that Boston was the place he always exempted from this criticism. Boston, he said, was his American home, and I think Longfellow deserves at least some of the credit for that. Anyway, Tomlin says the things he hated about America included its corrupt newspapers, violence, slavery, spitting, boastfulness and self-righteousness, obsession with business and money, greedy, graceless eating, hypocrisy about supposed equality, and the crude lionizing of visitors. And he converts all this into satirical fiction. And just the names of a few characters, and Martin Chuzzlewit will suggest this. There was Mr. Jefferson Brick, Mr. Lafayette Kettle, Mrs. Hominy, and Congressman Elijah Pogrom, and many others of that ilk. So this first trip, it's a mixed success in many ways. He has exposed himself to a vast new audience, at least some of whom were appreciative, and he's developed enough material to do these two books. Neither book, what was certainly the case of Martin Chuzzlewit, it was not a great commercial success, and he needed money at that point a great deal, and he wrote a small story in terms of the size, but one that you may have heard of called A Christmas Carol, and that did make him a lot of money, and perhaps is that his one most famous work of all time across the world? I don't know, perhaps. Dickens is back in London. He has enough money by this time to have moved into a much nicer house on the edge of Regent's Park in Devonshire Terrace. And when Longfellow is in Germany that fall, he's very unhappy. He's had an unpleasant teaching experience at Harvard. He's tragically in love with a woman, Fanny Appleton, who apparently does not love him and has rejected him after a 7-year courtship. And he goes off to the Rhine Valley to take the water cure, which is a bizarre business of having hot and then cold water poured over you various times during the day. And this is supposed to bring out whatever was bothering you. It's supposed to release it from your body. But what it really was a nice rest cure from getting away from Harvard and Boston. But at the end of that tour, when he has to go back to resume his duties at the insistence of the Harvard, he delays for 2 weeks in London and stays with Dickens at the house in Devonshire Terrace. And I think Dickens might have sympathized with him about Miss Appleton, because Dickens, in his own life, much earlier, had a 4-year unsuccessful, very unhappy courtship of a young woman, Maria Bednall, who may be a model for Estella in Great Expectations. But anyway, Dickens had that experience. Longfellow had a longer experience, so maybe they empathize on that matter, that level. But Dickens did act the genial host. He took Longfellow all over London, introduced him to all his friends, and there were many ceremonial banquets and what have you. But the most interesting episode of that whole visit is that one night Dickens takes Longfellow on a long ramble through the East End of London after dark. Dickens loved to walk. He would typically walk 10, 15, maybe 20 miles a day, sometimes by night. He knew every inch of London. He did this to gather material, of course, but also it was a way of working through in his head, I think, the dialogue that he would use in the stories and inventing characters as he went along, perhaps. So it was both exercise and a kind of preparatory stage of his writing. And I think it's correct to say he wrote without a lot of corrections. And that was because he'd written a lot of the stuff in his head ahead of time. When he went to some really dicey neighborhoods in the East End, he took a police constable along with him. But still, it was a fairly adventurous thing to do, and I don't know, I would love to have seen how young Longfellow reacted to this exposure to the grimmest and grittiest side of London, certainly, and it was quite a different experience from his life in genteel Cambridge. But I think it ties in not only with Dickens' fascination with the geography of London and the human geography of London, but Dickens was one of these Victorian Englishmen who was fascinated with prostitution. And one of his many philanthropic activities was to try to rescue young women from prostitution and put them in houses. An interesting parallel with what Mrs. Crawley does in Downton Abbey, if that is a show any of you have seen. She's 100 years later, but it was the idea of rescuing the fallen. And a lot of Victorian gentlemen engaged in that. I think Prime Minister Gladstone, that was one of his hobbies, to try and bring the prostitutes back to purity. At any rate, whether Longfellow saw any of that, there's no record of, but it's interesting to think that might have been part of his Dickens tour of London by night. So jumping ahead over that period when Dickens is producing his greatest work, much of it, to 1867 and his second trip to the New World. Circumstances changed a great deal. I mean, the Civil War had taken place, most obviously. Longfellow's wife had died tragically, as you know. His son had run off to the army. He'd gone through a lot of stress and strain. It's curious, we don't really know too much about Dickens' own attitude toward the Civil War. He certainly was anti-slavery, there's no question about that. But he seemed, at some point, at least early in the war, he seemed to have a kind of pox on both your heads attitude. He was not particularly, he was certainly not pro-Confederate, yet he wasn't particularly pro-Union either, and he thought it was a useless struggle, perhaps, in some sense. The great change in his life, of course, was by that point he had become estranged from his wife, Catherine. He had taken up with a teenage actress, Ellen Ternan, in 1857, and he had basically thrown his wife out of the house in 1858. He did set her up with his eldest son in another household and, you know, supported them financially, but he had the least possible to do with him from then on, especially Catherine. And if you have any questions about that, Lillian, I'm sure we'll be very happy to answer. It's a depressing but fascinating story, and finally Catherine's point of view is in print, and we have Lillian to thank. If you're curious about Ellen Ternan, Nellie, Claire Tomlin wrote a very, very readable short biography of her called The Invisible Woman. And she did a wonderful job of detective work, because Dickens had done everything possible, physically and intellectually, could to erase any record of her in his papers. He told his friends not to talk about her. He kept her hidden in another city and town and visited her quite surreptitiously. There's some evidence that she might have had a child by him, but he sent her to France. She lived in France for a period when the child might have been born. So it's a great secret in his life, and it's part of a... It's hard to judge Dickens in some kind of moral balance, because on the one hand, he's this extraordinary moralist and reformer and champion of the underprivileged and oppressed. And on the other hand, he has this really very sordid record of his treatment of women, particularly his wife. And, you know, his treatment of Ternan is very ambiguous. And, I urge you to read both books if you're curious about this. But the real question on this 1867 trip to Boston was, would Nellie be allowed to join him? I mean, he was going away for another six-month trip. Did he dare bring her to America? The excuse would have been she was going to visit her relatives in the United States. And he set up a system of code that he wrote a letter, and if certain words were in it, she was to come, and if not, she was to stay in Italy, where she was kind of hiding out at that time. But his advisors, his literary advisors, warned him that this would be a terrible idea, that Americans would be suspicious, and why was he traveling with this young woman? And he was very unhappy about this, obviously, and he was very attached to her, but she had to stay in Europe. So he went through the second trip, and again, a very exhausting itinerary. This time, it was a reading tour. One thing that Dickens, in his theatricality, loved to do was to read from his stories, and he attracted huge audiences and made a lot of money from this, both in at home and in the New World. What he would do would be to produce condensed versions of a novel, say, and he would do all the voices, act out all the characters, and he was apparently just amazingly good at this, and people would sit transfixed for 2-3 hours while he performed. Unfortunately, his health was bad by this point, and this type of performance and all this travel took a lot out of him. So by the end of the trip, he was really in pretty bad shape. But the upside of all of this was he made an awful lot of money. After he paid expenses, he cleared £20,000 from his American trip in 1867. And to give you some idea of what that represented, at that period, it's estimated that a family could live respectably, if not elegantly, but respectively, on £300 a year with a whole staff of servants and everything that went with it. So £300 a year to live a respectable upper middle class life, £20,000 profit from this trip, it gives you some idea of how eager people were to hear him, to see him perform. So the trip, it was New York, it was Boston, New York. He went as far as D.C. again, and upstate New York. And he came to New England. He didn't come all the way to Brunswick, but he got as close as Portland, Maine, at the end of his trip and gave one of his readings there. I would love to know more about that occasion. And there's one interesting little anecdote to that trip that I want to tell you very quickly. On the train back to Boston, he met a very self-possessed young lady of 12 who came into his coach and sat down with him and started talking, and she knew who he was, and she wanted to tell him that David Copperfield was her favorite book and wanted to talk about it. And they had a nice, Dickens was very good with children, and although not particularly good with his own children, he was good with strangers' children he met in his travels. So he had a long conversation the rest of the trip with her, and when they got to the station, he took her by the hand and returned her to her mother or whatever. And the young woman was Kate Douglas Wiggin. She writes about this incident in her autobiography much later. The author of Rebecca Sunnybrook Farm, and a longtime summer visitor to Maine. She had a summer house in Hollis, which is still there. And one of the teachers in one of these programs Richard mentioned I used to do was from Hollis and lived in that house. She and her husband had bought it. And she invited me to visit it one time, and I didn't know about the Dickens connection at that point. But what struck me, it's a wonderful Maine farmhouse with an L and a barn. And the barn had been converted by Kate Douglas Wiggin into a theater, kind of rustic, but still had a nice stage. And she and her friends in the summer, the summer people who came from Boston, New York, whatever, they would do these amateur theatricals there. And she would write plays, they'd act out the various roles. And it was part of the summer routine, and you can still see the stage there. And this, of course, was exactly what Dickens had done a generation earlier. He loved theatricals, amateur theatricals. He met Nellie Ternan when she was acting in a play he had written. He was really a man of the theater as much as a man of letters. So I wonder if somehow when Kate Douglas Wiggin read about this, maybe later it may have planted the idea in her mind that amateur theatricals were something that a writer ought to be doing. It's a remote conjecture, but I throw it out for what it might be worth. So there was one other time after those three visits, when when he was in Boston, let me add, he'd spent a good deal of time with Longfellow and the other friends. But the final trip the final visit that either of them had together was the next year, 1868, when Longfellow and his family, his wife is dead by this time, obviously, but he takes his children, his younger son had married by that point, and the wife goes with him. His brother-in-law, Tom Allen, the younger daughter's governess, and a couple other people. There's this entourage, and they do this kind of state tour of Europe, and Longfellow, of course, is welcomed everywhere as a great writer and a friend of Europe, and he's received by the Queen and the Prince of Wales and Franz Liszt and many other people. But as part of this long European tour in 1868, Longfellow takes his family to Dickens' house in Kent, a place called Gad's Hill that still exists. I think it's now a school. It's a house just outside of Rochester, and they spend the day there, apparently, and a very pleasant visit. 2 years later, Dickens drops dead in that house. Or he has a stroke at dinner and dies the next day, to be more accurate. And a few days later, he's buried in Westminster Abbey, among a great deal of commemoration. And Longfellow, at the time of Dickens' death, wrote this. He said, "Dickens was so full of life that it did not seem possible he could die. I never knew an author's death to cause such general mourning. It is no exaggeration to say that this whole country, meaning the United States, is stricken with grief." Now, Longfellow himself would live on till 1882, and by a nice balance, he too is he's not buried in Westminster Abbey, he's buried in Mount Auburn Cemetery, but there is a memorial to him in Westminster Abbey, not too far from the Dickens tomb. So the two friends are in some sense linked in a kind of architectural immortality, at least. So to conclude all this, I want to just throw out a few ideas on whether this friendship was anything more than just an enjoyable friendship, whether they, as writers, they got much from each other. And I will not say too much about Dickens, because I want to leave that for Lillian, but I'm told she makes the case that in creating a character like Joe Gargery in Great Expectations, that Dickens may be thinking of Longfellow's Village Blacksmith or some American character like that. I'm oversimplifying your argument, I'm sure, but I hope I'm somewhat on target. And I wish I had thought of that, I have to say. It's a wonderful connection. With Longfellow, there are some more obvious connections. One is that, in writing Evangeline, for example, I think he's very much writing in the mode of the Dickensian woman, the somewhat weak vessel that has to be protected. And there are other ways of reading Evangeline in which she is a very strong character, certainly. But the sentimental side of the story may owe something to Dickens. And it may just add something more generally to the Victorian male attitudes towards young women. You could argue maybe, again, a bit of a stretch, but it's not totally implausible that in writing the Tales of the Wayside Inn, Longfellow had in the back of his mind the Pickwick Papers, which is the story of a group of traveling friends who get into various comic episodes. And the Wayside Inn, they're telling stories to each other, but there's still that kind of Chaucerian element of a group of travelers. But most obviously, when Longfellow in 1843 produces his poems on slavery, it's a slim volume of about 10 poems, but that's a very early time for a New Englander of Longfellow's social and intellectual standing to be outspoken on the subject of slavery. And there are obviously a lot of other abolitionists beginning to be heard, and a poet like Whittier among them. But for someone in the Boston-Cambridge establishment to be so outspoken on the subject, and the poems aren't great poems necessarily, but as documents of the time, they're very moving, and they have some wonderful lines in them. And it was a bit risky for Longfellow because Fanny Appleton's father, Nathan Appleton, was a great textile manufacturer, and of course, the link between Southern cotton and New England textiles was crucial. So to criticize slavery, even in poetic format, was a bit bold. And I would like to argue that what pushes Longfellow to publish those poems, he writes them on the boat going back to North America after this 1842 water cure. It's not only his friendship with Sumner, who is a strong abolitionist, but it's his exposure to Dickens and Dickens' attitude towards those who are oppressed and who have been abused and taken advantage of and literally enslaved by others. So I throw that out, and I will end just with a brief mention that after Dickens died, Nellie had a second life. She was still relatively young, a very attractive woman, and they had been so good at keeping it all a secret. A handful of people knew about it, and they were willing to keep their mouths shut. Nellie kind of reinvented herself and married a very respectable Victorian gentleman. I think maybe he was a clergyman, I can't remember. But so she has a second life, totally divorced from her, I think maybe 12 years or so with Dickens. And the Victorians are far stranger than we give them credit for, and how they can pull these things off and still look so pious and virtuous and Victorian is what remains a mystery. So I skimmed over a lot of stuff, and certainly had far more to say about Dickens than Longfellow, but I think you all know the Longfellow story, and the Dickens side of it may be something a little bit new. So thank you for your attention, and it is 5:15, and this clock is correct, and you're probably ready for another cup of coffee. But again, thanks very much, and thank you, Mary Lee. And I hope Longfellow Days continue for many, many years to come.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.